I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. When the scientist Edward Wilson refers to ants as the little things that run the world, he's not kidding. For years, he has been studying and explaining the intricacies of the social structure of ants, their political organization, their farming skills, their housing skills, their terrifying tactics in combat. His latest work takes us actually back to a time when art and science weren't so separate. It is a monograph. It is the result of some 18 years of work studying, identifying, cataloging, and describing the different species of the Phaidolae, one genus of the ant. And it is gathered together in an elegantly bound reference for people to examine in years to come. Now, it's true that these days anyone with a good eye and a digital camera and a small laptop uplink can zap their images of iguanas and ants into our greater consciousness and our science web files, but this type of scholarship is different. This is personal. This is achingly slow work, and it's all the more elegant for that. So, Connection listeners, what do we learn from those unflinchingly committed to the natural world? What does this kind of passionate, hands-on study teach us that we're not getting from the CD-ROM? And what did you discover from your own scientific obsession, if you have one? Our number's 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Just a quick note, we do have on our own webpage at theconnection.org a number of the photographs and some of Mr. Wilson's drawings. So if you want to get a little hint of what the book looks like, you can find that on our website. My guest is the scientist, Ed Wilson. Welcome back to The Connection.
Thank you, Dick.
Nice to have you here. I need to start with a little bit of Ant 101, Phaidolae. I know it as one genus, but what does it really mean?
Phaidolae is from the Greek. It means thrifty. And when we give scientific names, that is Latinized names, some derived from Greek, but Latinized, to species, to put them into a formal catalog and official status, then we just pick words from any source.
So are we talking about a type of ant?
And then we Latinize them.
In a certain geographic area, or is it a certain type of ants which could be found?
It's a certain type of ant that makes up the genus Phaidolae. Genus Phaidolae is sometimes called a big-headed ants because they have a soldier cast with huge heads that are full of adductor muscles that bring mandibles together to work like wire clippers. I think in reference to the aforementioned terribleness of ants, they are terrible down at their miniature level, and this particular genus has a soldier cast that is extremely formidable in combat in that Lilliputian world. So it is a group of ants similar to one another and of common ancestry. That's why we put all of these species that I've described into a single genus, you know, genus like Homo, or Canis dogs. This is Phaidolae, yeah.
My favorite ant fact, I just have to say, is I think probably from your Pulitzer Prize-winning book, Ants, where tell me if I get this wrong, but if you were able to herd every single living animal in the world onto one great big weigh scale, that 10% of the weight would be ants. Is that right?
That's close. Yes.
So do I get like an 80% on that answer, Professor?
You do indeed, but the session has just begun. That's an amazing fact. In the Amazon, for example, where ants are particularly abundant, but this is true of large parts of the rest of the world. In the Amazon, they've been measured this way. And ants alone weigh four times as much as all of the land vertebrates, such as mammals, birds, amphibians, and reptiles put together.
And what you're doing with this new monograph is it's not the sum total of the weight, but it's digging into the genus to figure out how many different species are there. And I think, I get the impression, you can tell me if I'm wrong, that you sort of surprised yourself with what you found.
Phaidolae was the Mount Everest of ant classification. We had huge numbers of species that no one could identify. And it was holding up ecology not just the study of insects, but ecology, because these are the most abundant of the ants in the Western Hemisphere. They're the most diverse. But nobody could crack it because there were too many species. And so I decided to climb it leisurely over a number of years and finally mastered all of the species that were at hand. But even now, after 624 species from the New World, the right. Western Hemisphere, new species continue to pour in. This will end up as one of the largest genera, you know, assemblage of organisms like this in the world.
You've got 624 in this book. How many of those were new discoveries, new classifications?
337 at the point that I published the book, 337 new species. This will surprise a lot of people that there could be that many new species out there, and these are not that inconspicuous. They're not microbes, but that's the way the world is. We know very little about diversity on this planet.
It's a very big book. I want to try and respect the table that I'm working at and assure our listeners that there's no ants, but that's... Yeah. That's a big book.
That's what I call my masterwork. It's big enough, if dropped from a three-story building, to kill a man.
Or completely ruin the roof of a car.
I ruined his day anyway.
Can I get you to turn to, sir, page 433. I don't know if you've got a little tab on it there, but I wanted to ask you about this Phidolae. How do you pronounce that? Phidolae?
Harrison Fordyce.
Harrison Fordyce.
Right.
Sounds a little familiar to me.
Well, it does. And when scientists name new species, sometimes they name them. They're patronym. They name them after people. And ordinarily, scientists in doing a highly detailed study of this would name it after each other. You know, who discovered the thing? I mean, who first brought in the specimens? Who's doing the most work in the group and so on. But I kind of broke from tradition here, and I've gotten nothing but approval from my colleagues by naming a dozen species after people who have made signal contributions to global conservation.
Now, this is not because Harrison Ford plays a swashbuckling archaeologist in film. That's not why his name is on this particular
That's not why his name is there. Right. He could have never appeared in anything but B films of the 1950s. and he would be there because he's a fellow member of the board of directors of Conservation International. And Harrison is an absolute trooper. He not only contributes substantial amounts of money to the cause of saving the world biodiversity, but is an extremely active member of the board. He's in the field a great deal, and he ranks among our leading lay conservation supporters.
When you're doing this kind of study, gathering together all these different species, does most of it come in carefully sealed little envelopes from Costa Rica? Here, Ed, take a look at these, see if they're different. Here's what I can tell you about them. Or are you traveling around yourself and gathering up a lot of them?
Both. I've done a lot of collecting, but I also have gathered material from others who have collected intensively in different parts of the world, colleagues, some of whom are not ant specialists, but they pick these up as part of their own work because they're so abundant. And then we put them together in the museum at Harvard from alcohol specimens. That is mainly specimens collected in 80% alcohol, and then through a series of steps, which I will not stupefy listeners reciting, we transform them into dried specimens mounted on pins, actually little triangles on pins. And we have about 1 million specimens in Harvard's collection, which is the largest in the world. And it's from that material that we draw specimens known and unknown to complete a study of this kind.
And I should point out to our listeners that this particular monograph contains some 5,000 of your own drawings of various different...
Yes, that's correct.
Ant parts,
I did
ant
over 5,000 drawings of my own to illustrate it.
Did you come to ants late in life? Did you discover as a fully educated scientist that this was the creature that deserved your study, or did you start earlier than that?
I started at the age of 9.
So you already had a PhD.
Yes, and worked on, I should say, remained fascinated by ants, starting working on them, I think, rather seriously as I got ready to go to college at 16. But there's nothing remarkable about that because the way I like to put it, then I ended up in this area of science because every kid has a bug period, and I just never grew out of it. I just so much loved being an entomologist and working in the field with these tiny creatures that I never saw any reason to leave it.
It's something that suits your vision, though. You've got the type of eye that likes to look at something pinched between a thumb and a forefinger that's held about 12 inches in front of you. Isn't that true?
I have very sharp vision, but I also have vision in only one eye. When I was a kid, I accidentally blinded my right eye. I was actually fishing when I did it.
And, you put a fish hook in your eye?
It was a fish fin.
Ooh.
Yeah, I know. Unpleasant.
Yeah, don't think, move past
at any
that.
Rate, so I adjusted to life with not very good distance vision. That prevented me from being a first-rate bird watcher and moved me toward what I call the little things, as you say, that can be held between thumb and forefinger. And because I have very sharp vision close up, I had found my niche.
Now, one of your niches is also the study of how ants behave. And one of we'll talk later in the program, but just in brief, if the ants are arriving in envelopes and you know, in alcohol, how do you know what it is that they do and what characteristics distinguish them in the wild?
Well, that's where field work comes in. as part of our work, outside the laboratory and in the field, where we go to fascinating places to collect and study ants. I've been, for example, New Guinea, Sri Lanka, Central America, the Amazon, several times and so on. That's the fun part. And there we set up behavioral studies right there in the field in camps. We also bring colonies back and set them up in the laboratory and let them do their thing. And out of this comes experiments, right down to, in some cases, chemistry and detailed studies. And we thus gradually are unfolding, revealing, I should say, the secrets of the ant world.
And the secrets of the ant world, Connection listeners, have more to do with just ants. We'll talk about that when we come back after our break. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. What is it that we are learning from this painstaking study of what's under the soles of our shoes? Do you stop to think about that? 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. Dick Gordon, you're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. We're talking with the preeminent biologist, Edward Wilson. He has a new book called Fidoli in the New World. It's a monograph about those often underestimated but complex, sophisticated insects, the ants. It took nearly 20 years for Mr. Wilson to create this one book. Connection listeners, what do we learn from that kind of commitment to the natural world? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. Also, a note to check our website at theconnection.org because our web wizard, Sarah, has put together a collection of photographs and some of Mr. Wilson's drawings that you can take a look at. Why ants? What are we getting by taking a look at ants in particular?
I'd like to make a general answer, and then I'll make a specific one very briefly, and that is that a large part of the future of biology And a large part of the future of how we manage this planet, whether we manage it with wisdom and knowledge, depends on how close and personal we get up to the world's biological diversity. And that's what this is an example of. At 624 species is what I cover here. 20% of all of the known ants from ants known from the New World. Why go to that trouble? And well, the reason is that biology is very much a descriptive science, in spite of all the physics and chemistry that underlie it. And the ecosystems of the world are made up of these elements that we need to know a great deal about in detail. Each one of these species is a masterpiece of evolution. Some of these I know from my studies of fossil ants, you know, in the amber, for example, the Dominican Republic, go back, or their immediate ancestors, for 30 million years or more. It's taken that long to create this diversity of life that I've studied in this one genus. And each species, then, you could spend a lifetime studying. It has a place in nature, and it has a great deal to teach us, from genetics on up to its importance in the ecosystem. So the biodiversity, up close and personal, and that's what this is all about.
So if I have this layman sense that there are red ants and black ants and fire ants and carpenter ants, I'm missing more than just something that I'd memorize for a test in one of your classes. I might be missing something about one species of one ant that would unlock something for us, mm-hmm. for me, or for all of us, in terms of understanding why this piece of land is developed the way it is. I'm guessing now. Is that what you're telling me?
Yeah, that's exactly right. There's something like 12,000 species known at the present time. We think there may be double that. Let me just give you an example out of a long list of what you can learn.
Okay.
Just recently came back from the Dominican Republic, where I believe I've successfully solved a 500-year-old mystery, which is the nature and the significance of the ant plague that almost drove the Spanish out of Hispaniola and maybe a good part of the West Indies in 1518. This ant has been its nature. It was recorded then. It was recorded in similar plagues through the West Indies in the subsequent 2 centuries as huge pest. Agriculture,
invading people's homes. In their clothes, in their gardens.
Everything, yeah. Yes, that's right. The Spanish in 1519 even designated a saint to pray to, and Governor Columbus, Diego Columbus, Christopher's son, governor, moved Santo Domingo across the river to get away from the ant. You know, this kind of thing. It's history. And I think I saw that.
But what didn't they know? What was missing in the
They just knew there was an ant that was causing a terrible amount of trouble. And so what I've done, I've nailed it down, I'm pretty think, to a kind of fire ant that occurs today in the West Indies. And I think, without going into detail, our time is limited, I think I understand why it became a plague. And why is this important today, other than a footnote in the history of the West Indies, of the New World? And it's because plagues of insects, including ants, are becoming commonplace around the world. There is a fire ant, not much unlike the one that punished the Spanish settlers, yeah. In the 1500s, that has spread throughout the southern United States. That's the imported red fire ant, which is causing huge amounts of damage. That's another ant plague.
I want to look over your shoulder as you do some of this, and I'm wondering if mm-hmm. I can get you to I'm on page 548, looking at the Phidoli truncula, marked as a new species from Costa Rica, there's so many words in here that I can't pronounce. Those are about the only ones on the page I can't pronounce.
You're doing pretty well.
I liked your description of what it is that distinguishes this ant. And I wonder if you can just sort of let us, as I said, look over your shoulder. And you're taking a look at this new species. What makes it different from the others?
Well, among Phidolae fanciers, whose numbers I hope we're increasing at least slightly today, this is one of the species of Phidolae in which the soldiers, the big-headed soldiers, which, as I mentioned earlier, in most of the species are specialized for working their mandibles like wire cutters, and they are able to chop up their enemies that way. That's extremely effective. This species is one of a small subgroup within Phidolae, which has plug-shaped heads. You know, it's just like a cork-shaped of a wine bottle. And they don't use their mandibles so much to chop enemies into pieces, but they use their heads to plug up the entrances to the nest. It's just
trapping the enemies in their homes or trapping keeping the enemies from coming into their homes?
As the enemy approaches. It could be an alien type of ant, it could be a small spider or whatever. The soldiers move into positions at the little cylindrical nest holes.
Okay, everybody, you know, plug all the holes.
Yeah, that's right. The soldiers then line up and they stick their heads in those plugs, you know, just bottle them up. And the front part of the head that sticks to the outside is often armored.
And so it can't be chopped
up. Very thick and armored.
See,
yeah, that's right.
I'm imagining you looking at these in the field and trying to figure out how it is you conclude that they do that actually on purpose instead of concluding that they're just very dense ants and they're trying to get out and their head gets stuck in the hole. Because you have to figure out that it's an intentional defensive mechanism instead of, look at those silly ants, their heads are forever getting stuck in the hole.
Well, it's never intention, you know, in the same sense that we understand and deal with intention in our forebrain, you know, conscious,
right.
Recalling memories and deciding what the scenarios for the future will be, et cetera, and meaning. The ants are going through complicated behavior, but basically they're automata. They have a limited number of actions that they perform, and they have certain what we call decision rules. Depending on the context, where they are, what the stimuli are, they respond in one or the other of several ways, and this can be then a sequence of actions that lead up to fairly complicated behavior overall, particularly when they're doing it in a group, when they're interacting while they're doing this socially.
You wouldn't want 1.7 million lateral thinking ants all working on the same problem. Very long conversation.
No.
I wonder if we can take a minute to go to our phones now to Louisville, Kentucky. Now, Nick's joining us. Hi, Nick.
Hi. Two-part question for the doctor. The first question: if you could speak to the ants, if you could communicate with them, what three questions would you have for them? And second.
That's already three questions.
Well, I also want to know, would they be able to communicate an answer back to you? Would certain species be able to give you a more intelligent response than others?
We do communicate with the ants. That's something my colleagues and I did starting in the late 50s and through the 60s.
How?
They communicate with each other by pheromones. These are chemicals that they release from the surface of their body, from gland openings. An ant's body is packed full of exocrine glands, that is, you know, glands that secrete things like we secrete sweat,
right.
And open to the outside. And we now know that there are some 10 or 20 major categories of signals that ants use for the purpose of communication. The other ants smell or taste those pheromones when they come out. And early on, we discovered that we could communicate with the ants, sometimes with the pure chemicals that we synthesized after we had identified their pheromones. We could synthesize.
You could convince the ants to do something?
Yes. We could alarm them in a particular way. We could lead them.
I can do that by jumping up and down on their nest.
I know, but not by the specific way they alarm each other, you know, releasing.
What you mean.
They do when you jump up and down is they release these alarm substances. Well, we could lead them elsewhere. We can make them think that a little dummy that we give them with some corpse material.
Is actually a dead end.
Isn't actually a dead end, and they will obediently carry it out.
So are you
communicate with them at that level. Now, to do it like the gentleman from Louisville
right.
suggests, to actually converse with them, no, the ants do not have a conscious mind.
Do you allow yourself a break from practical science to ever wonder what question you would ask if you could ask it? Because I think that's what Nick was saying. You know, if there's one thing about the way they behave or what they do, that's hard to crack. Is there, or are you pretty good at figuring most of that stuff out on your own?
You know, I would like to ask. I'd like to be able to do that with a chimp, but it's to me, it's inconceivable that I could do that with an ant. In other words, I already believe I know what the ant is, quote, thinking, and roughly why it's thinking certain thing, and how the brain might work. Although we've got a long way to go on that. So it's not a very interesting question for me right now as to what an ant might be thinking.
But a lot of that is in the book in its own way, because by figuring out mm-hmm. what the shape of the Phidolae trunculus head is for,
yes.
you
yes.
know what its job is. And by knowing what its job is, you sort of have a large part of it answered.
We can
right?
get a pretty good fix on the entire repertory that an ant species has. And we do that fairly routinely now. And we can also connect that up with anatomical characteristics and its lifestyle. And that work, I should say, species by species, is just beginning worldwide on not just ants or insects, but the right. world fauna generally.
All right. Nick, thanks for that. To now Fukuoka, Japan, and Kevin is joining us by the website, I guess, Kevin?
No, using 440 satellite.
All right. Nice to have you attached to us by satellite. What's your question?
Well, years ago I read a book called Beak of the Finch, and it's by Jonathan Weiner. It's about a Princeton couple who sends teams down to the Galapagos Islands to study Darwin's finches. And basically what they've shown by doing the same kind of research year after year after year is that evolution can be observed actively in nature and not just through the fossil record.
Right.
And I was wondering, in his 18 years of research, if he observed anything like that with his ants.
Yes, good point. Incidentally, let me recommend a magnificent new monograph produced by a team of Japanese entomologists called The Ants of Japan.
The Ants of Japan.
Yes, that's right. Should you ever want to pursue this in Japan, it's just so beautifully illustrated and so thoroughly documented. That's a standard for that sort of thing. Well, anyway, the point is that yes, the answer to your question is yes. One of the best examples is that of the red imported fire ant that came from South America, was introduced in the 30s. Into the southern United States, has become a major pest across the entire southern United States and now Southern California, which before our very eyes went through a change, a genetic change that's been pinned down to one gene and has radically changed the social structure of a colony of fire ants in a way that makes them much more unified and also a much worse pest than they were before.
And you,
fascinating.
Kevin, thanks for your call.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
Did I pronounce the name of your town right?
Fukuoka.
Fukuoka. Mm-hmm. I'll get it right next time you call in, okay?
You have to be careful with it, the first part.
Thanks for the warning.
All right, then.
Our number is 1-800-423-8255. And where are we going next? I think I can get this one. Lancaster, Massachusetts. Pete's on the line. Hi, Pete.
Good morning.
Thanks for calling.
What an intriguing program. I spent 6 years teaching in West Africa and became familiar with army ants. And these critters, I used to amuse myself occasionally by taking my shoe across their column when they were on the march and see how long it would take them to regroup. Usually somewhere between 4 and 6 minutes. And, of course, as soon as you do that, the soldiers are out there with their mandibles open, which they usually are along the march anyway. But They can give you a nasty cut, not a bite.
How big are these ants, the army ants, Pete?
Well, the soldiers are probably somewhere between 3/4 and an inch. And the workers that go in the column inside are, half inch or smaller. But occasionally they would come into our houses, and they were welcome, cleaning out all the roaches and any other critters that might be in there. But occasionally, in the evening sometimes, you might find them approaching the crib of your infants. And that could be real nasty if they got there. But what I really wanted to tell you before I hang up, I encountered a puff adder in my wastebasket one time and dispatched it, laid it outside on my back porch to take it down to my lab to pickle the next morning. Came back the next morning after I was ready to go, and they had cleaned it. I had shreds of skin left, but they had eaten the muscles, everything, even the ligaments, so that I didn't even have a skeleton that would hold together.
Well, that was the answer, and I'll ask the question.
Sure. Oh, you have to be quick because we're running out of time. But go
ahead. The question is, what is one of the most interesting ants to be found in Africa, the driver ant? And thank you very much.
That's what these were.
Yes.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah. Driver.
All right.
Sure enough.
Pete, thanks
thank
a lot
you,
for
sir.
Your call.
Thanks.
Nice to have you on the program. 1-800-423-8255. My guest is the biologist Edward O. Wilson. We're talking about his new monograph, and I'm going to close it so I get the title right. Phidoli in the New World, a Dominant Hyperdiverse Art Genus. Yep. And our number is 1-800-423-8255. We'd like to have you in on our conversation. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. Listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. My name's Dick Gordon. My guest is the scientist, Ed Wilson. We're looking at his brand new monograph on ants, Phidoli in the New World. And class, if you would open your pages to book to page 549, we're just going to begin with Megacephala. I'm told that this is a particularly nasty creature. Is that accurate?
Yeah. Phidoli megacephala. Before I come to another villain in the piece, let me just mention first the nice things about ants. That
in case they're getting a bad rap.
Yeah. The ants of the world are probably essential to maintain the land environment. They are the principal turners of the soil. They far exceed earthworms. They are the principal predators of small creatures, other insects, and so on. And they are the cemetery workers. More than 90% of small animals are carted off and consumed. They turn, by all these means, the soil of habitats around the world. So there are lots of good guys. Phidoli megacephala is one of the ones that has run amok, unfortunately, in the genus Phidoli. And that's a special interest because it comes from Africa and has spread around the world, including the New World, very abundant over here in the Western Hemisphere. That's why I included it, of course. And it's a great destroyer. It's a super abundant where it occurs. It drives out other ant species, and it is also a real concern to conservationists because we know, for example, in Hawaii, where Phidoli megacephala took over, Hawaii never had ants. All of the plants and animals, birds, everything else evolved without ants present, which is amazing. Mm-hmm. And megacephala got into Hawaii.
Do we know how long ago? I mean, was it on one of the Polynesian boats? Or?
Probably it was, for megacephala, it probably was only after the European colonists began to arrive in the and American in the 1700s. But we know that this one species wiped out a large part of all of the native insect fauna and probably had an important influence in eliminating bird species as well. So it's just an example of how important just one species out of these hundreds can come, we have become. We don't know. It's very hard to predict in advance because we're changing the world so fast and spreading species like this around the world, exactly which ones are going to cause the greatest problems or, in some cases, benefits. That's why we need to know all of these species in advance.
Now, and, I mean, Darwin would have, if were he sitting here with us, would say that extinction is an important part of evolution. Do you look at something like the arrival of an ant like that in Hawaii and the gobbling up of whatever native insects might have been there as a sort of, you know, that's just the way the world is going to be, or do you think that it's only really acceptable as long as it's not the sort of thing that's being imported by humans and messed about by us?
Yeah, the problem is that right now, overall, from various causes, habitat destruction, introducing invasive species that cause a lot of damage like our Bidoli megacephala,
right.
We have raised, human activity has raised the extinction rate by probably on the order of 1,000 times over what it was before humans came along. But we've reduced the number, the rate at which new species are arriving. So, Earth is going to run out of species, or a large part of the species, in the next century, unless we do something about it. And that's the take-home line, I think, from the practical aspects of studying groups like this in such detail.
1-800-423-8255. Back to the phones to Buffalo, New York, and Bill's joining us. Hi, Bill.
Hi. When I was a little kid, one of my favorite toys were ants. And I used to do all
live ones or dead ones?
Terrible things to them from my father's tool shed. But what I'd like to know is, since you can't beat them, and wouldn't want to beat them anyway, but I've heard that there are certain plants that you could plant around your house that would keep them away from your house. And also I want to know if there's other plants that attract ants like peonies do that maybe you should keep away from your house if you want to keep ants away.
I'm not so sure about ants that are natural repellents. Undoubtedly, there are plants that are produce general insect repellents, and they're everywhere. But among the plants that attract ants are the peonies, as you just mentioned them, which have a nectar that attracts insects. And there are plants around the world that actually grow special structures that house ants. In most of these, or maybe all of these cases that we have studied, the plants use the ants for defense. Instead of just having spines or poisonous leaves or whatever, they have ants. And that's why they bother human beings. Namely, you get too close to them and their ants will defend them. So that's a natural part of life. And I would say to you and others who are concerned about having ants around, unless they're actually invading your house, enjoy them.
I have to sort of join with you a little bit, Bill, and confess that among my dark secrets about inhaling or not inhaling is also having had squashed a few ants as a small child. When you say they were your toys, do you mean that you were just inventing new ways to kill them?
Mostly, yeah. Oil. I could change a black ant to a white ant by putting fertilizer on it, watching it crawl out. Things like that.
We don't want to give too many ideas to our younger listeners here, but I'm wondering whether or not in listening to Ed Wilson today, you're ready to head off to confession
I'd never do any of that stuff again. But one thing I'm wondering is when there's layers of ants, and they're just fascinating. You look at a layer of ants, I just don't understand how they can communicate like that when there's...
You mean ants on top of ants on top of ants?
Yeah, and when I was a little kid, I especially liked to push them and watch them all scatter, but now I'd never do that. It just seems cruel, but... how do they communicate like that?
We were talking about that a little earlier. It's done mainly by pheromones.
But with that many, there can't be thousands of different conversations going on at the same time. And what you're saying is Oh, there are?
Oh, yes. We have worked out a lot of the physics of that. Some pheromones release, spread rapidly, and cover large numbers, for example, alarm substances. Others just short distances and serve other purposes, such as recruiting locally and so on. And yet others can be detected only by virtual contact with each other, and they serve yet other purposes like identifying. So the ants over millions of years have worked out the biophysics of this as to which pheromones they will have and how rapidly they evaporate and how quickly they're picked up. And it's an amazing world, a social milieu of ants.
Yes, I have so many questions and other callers who want to get in as well. So, Melinda is going to join us next. She's calling in from Raleigh, North Carolina. Hi, Melinda.
Hey, how are you guys doing? I'd like to share an ant story. I went to the Amazon in Peru, in the jungles of Peru in November, and the scariest thing we encountered the whole time there was something called a battle ant. At least that's what our guide called it. One night we were taking a night hike in the forest, in the rainforest, and our guide had showed us a battle ant. It was about an inch long. It was a formidable-looking ant, and said that several years ago he had gotten bitten by a battle ant on his leg, and his leg was paralyzed for 3 days, so he said, beware of ants. Well, as we were on this night hike, we spotted a tarantula just off the trail, and he stepped 1 foot off the trail as we were looking at the tarantula and got bitten, got stung, 16 times by an ant. And we thought he was going to have a heart attack. He was jumping up and down, screaming. We thought he was going to tear his pants off, but he didn't do that. And he's like, I've been bitten by ants. And we all thought, oh, my gosh, he's not going to make it. And so we quickly abandoned the hike and went home. And apparently that night, our guide had nightmares and was calling out in the night about these ants. And it turns out he didn't get bitten by the battle ant this time. It was a medium-sized ant. But after that, I don't care what we saw. Nothing was as scary as the lowly ant.
I wonder if that's Melinda, thanks for your call. I wonder if that level of sort of the lethal nature of them is in the jungle is something that's also cataloged or is part of this jungle lore.
Really, there's only one ant that could fit that description, and it's called a bullet ant.
Bullet, as in?
Bullet, yeah.
Okay.
They're among the largest ants in the world, and they have a severe sting, which is lasting. I think it's a neurotoxin. In parts of South America, they call them the dos semana ants, which is 2 weeks ant. That's how long it takes to completely recover.
To get the poison.
I've never been stung by one. I've always carefully avoided them. But, you know, they are no more of a risk than motorcycles when you're crossing the street. It's just something you watch out for, like you do anything that might harm you. Rainforest, let me stress, is one of the safest places in the world to be, and ants are among the safest creatures on Earth to be close to. The bullet ant, to the contrary, notwithstanding.
I'm wondering, when our interview's finished and you walk down the hallway and go out the door onto St. Paul Street and they're sort of standing by the wall waiting for your ride or looking for your car, however you're going to make your way home from here, if you were just standing there and saw one ant crawling up the wall of the building that we're in right now, do you just go, huh, got that one, it's this, and move on? Or is there some of that 9-year-old in you that just wonders where the ant's going and ends up getting distracted? I mean, you've been doing it for so long now. I don't know whether or not you tire of it.
I never tire of it, but I am able to identify these ants at a glance, the way a good bird watcher can identify a warbler or a certain kind of warbler or other kind of bird by the way it flies through a certain part of the vegetation and so on. But I wouldn't stop and pay a lot of attention to an ant species that I know well, and I know a lot of research has been done on, because I've already got that we've got that stored in literature. I've got a part of it stored in my head. But when I go to other places, and I do when I can, particularly the tropics where most different kinds are found, then very quickly an ant specialist, as a specialist in any group of plants or animals, is encountering forms that have never been studied, sometimes even brand new forms. And yeah, it's you know, it's the equivalent of art historian being turned loose in the Louvre.
You know, art is a lot of what you do, because you love to write. You're a beautiful writer. You love to draw. That's clear from looking at the book. That's an important part of science for you, isn't it?
Yeah, it's the visual and the oral stimulation of the world.
It is always a pleasure having you in the studio. You're welcome back here, with or without your ants or monographs, anytime. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thanks, Dick.
Ed Wilson, his new book, Phidolae in the New World, a Dominant Hyperdiverse Ant Genus. Just a reminder, Connection listeners, photographs of the ants and some of the drawings on our website. A special thanks today to our departing intern, Lisa Ruffino, who's been with us for some time. We're sorry to see her go. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.
You know, my mother never had time for me. You know, when you're the middle child in a family of 5 million, you don't get any attention. I mean, how's it possible? And I've always had these abandonment issues which plagued me. My father was basically a drone, like I've said. And, you know, the guy flew away when I was just a larva. And my job, don't get me started on, because it really annoys me. I was not cut out to be a worker. I'll tell you right now. I feel physically inadequate. My whole life, I've never been able to lift more than 10 times my own body weight. And when you get down to it, handling dirt is not my idea of a rewarding career. It's this whole gung-ho super organism thing that I, you know, I can't get. I try, but I don't get it. I mean, you know, what is it? I'm supposed to do everything for the colony. And what about my needs? What about me?